You pressed play on this podcast with the click of curiosity. It is another dimension, a dimension of mind, a dimension where nothing is sacred and everything is explainable. You're streaming into a land of both inside and outside, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into the midside.
Welcome to the midside, where if it burns when we pee, it burns when all our Eskimo brothers and sisters pee. The recent releases of Interstellar and Mockingjay have taught me a valuable lesson. I don't have to try to be a contrarian. You're all making it easy on me. Now, I don't mean that being a contrarian is something to strive for. I certainly thought so in my younger years, but I was immature. What I mean is, I can't help it. Simply by liking what I like, I exist outside of the conventional. In the middle of Mockingjay, on the verge of tears as I was most of the movie, I turned to my girlfriend in shock and whispered, "This is good, like, really good." She replied, "I know, and I read that it was filler." You call it filler? I call it killer. And not just to be different. That's what it's like to live on the midside. Joining me today, via Skype, from our nation's capital, Daniel T. Richards. How are you, Daniel?
I am refreshed and rejuvenated and ready to be subjugated to your iron will.
Yeah, you guys had a week without me. How did that go?
It went.
It definitely went, and you know how it was from my side?
Boring. How was it? Any week without you just must be just a tremendous burden on your ears.
It is. I just wanted someone to go over the top so badly. I was like, where is Sylvester Stallone with his hat backwards?
No. You run it in this sort of semi-absurdist kind of way. I ran it more like the McLaughlin group.
Yeah, it was far too straight-laced for me.
What's your take on the Middle East? Elliot!
We're witnessing the farce here, Daniel. We're witnessing the farce.
Certainly.
Although William did a great job. It was good to have him here.
Oh, yeah. Big shout-out to William, who did a tremendous job filling in. Thank you.
Yes, thank you for replacing me, William, you bastard. Also joining me via Skype from the House of Mouse, Elliot Rivera. How are you, Elliot?
I'm in mourning. I really miss the title of Generalissimo that I had last week. So I'm just back to being the token gay. But I will keep my head high and continue forward.
I can give you a new title. You want a new title?
What? I'm Smith again.
For today's episode, you are Shathid.
The what? Shathid?
Spell it out.
I spelled it out. Don't worry. I know it.
Thank you.
All right. You know who else doesn't try to be different, yet still confuses everyone with their decisions? NFL referees. It's the news with Daniel T. Richards.
We cover some important topics here on the midside, and this is probably among the most important. NFL refs fist bump okay after Broncos TD, says NFL. For all of you non-football-y people out there, I think that's all of you who listen.
That's me.
The Broncos
Hey. William is a football fan, okay?
Oh.
And Drew is a football fan. So there's two audience members.
Yeah, but he's in Canada, so.
Canadian football
doesn't count. Is it real football in Canada?
No, I would like to point out he's Canadian, but he is a Patriots fan, so.
Oh, suddenly this segment got a lot more interesting for one person. That's what we strive for here on the midside. So the Broncos are a football team, and they played this past weekend against the Buffalo Bills, who had a significant.
Two evil teams who we hate.
Yes, but we wanted the Bills to win, or at least I did.
Yes.
And the Bills had a great, multiple great chances to win, save for the fact that they're a terrible team.
I was going to say, wanting the Bills to win is like wanting the Revolution to win MLS Cup. I'm just going to end up in tears like I was again on Sunday.
Right, exactly. Long live whatever the team was they played. I have no idea what you're talking about. So after C.J. Anderson, who is a running back, that is someone who runs with the football into the end zone to score points, scored his second touchdown of the day, the Broncos celebrated, but so did the referees. Moments after he broke the plane on the end zone, the umpire, Carl Paganinelli, Justin can fix that, and line judge John Hussey fist bumped each other after they made what turned out to be the correct call. Although from the perspective of the viewer, it looked like they were fist pumping over the Broncos' touchdown, which seemed mildly, if not wildly, inappropriate to the average viewer.
Look, if there was a conspiracy in favor of the Broncos, I would be the first one revealing it. I would be like, see, they all love Peyton Manning and want him to win. But this is so stupid. This is,
This is
Twitter, okay? This is where we align with Michael Bay, where I align with Michael Bay. I swear to God, it's the same 50 people, and they just sit around all day and watch TV, and they pick random things to just get incensed about. This was it on Sunday.
Yeah. I agree. I think the funny thing here is the perception, not the reality. I thought it was, it's one of those things that it probably happens a lot more than we know, whether it's fist bumps or high fives with the refs, but this was one that happened to be captured at a really inopportune moment on national television.
In the middle of the frame.
In the right dead center frame. So it was kind of amusing. Plus, I like to hate on the Broncos. So.
Right, and I want to play a clip here from the former head of officials, Mike Pereira, who's now a talking head on Fox Sports. He talks about officiating and what the calls are and if they're right or wrong. And I think his reaction to this is so refreshing, and it's just completely correct. So I'm going to play that right now.
I'm amazed at people on Twitter who love to chat when they don't know what they're talking about. I'm even more amazed when people in the media write things that have no basis or merit to be written. And we're talking here about 3 minutes to go in the second quarter of the Denver game when Anderson goes up the middle. He goes in a bunch of bodies. The line judge can't see the ball. So the umpire comes in, looks to see where Anderson is, gives a thumbs up to the line judge to indicate that he's broke the plane. Then the line judge signals touchdown. Perfect mechanics. So what does the line judge do? He gives a fist bump to the umpire, thanking him for the information to make the right call. And people say they want Denver to win. I've never heard such ridiculousness in my life. These are guys that are out there doing the job. Great communication, great mechanics. Are they not allowed to acknowledge each other? That's insane. It's one thing to be criticized, but it's another thing to be criticized by people who have no idea what they're talking about. End of subject.
I try so hard not to crack up every time I watch this. It's the funniest thing I've ever heard. Because he's like, I've never heard something so ridiculous in my life. Clearly, you are not on Twitter often. But here's the most important point he makes. At the beginning, he says, people on the internet, on social media, are saying this. Okay, fine. People are going to say whatever they want on social media. But he also says that writers in the media are writing about this. We have to, as a culture, start distinguishing between what people say on social media and what the media publishes. And by we, I mean the media needs to start holding itself to that standard. They have to rise above it and realize there's a difference between pandering for ratings and actually being responsible with what they're reporting and reporting on reality.
Never. Not going to happen. Forget it. Already out the window.
We never kind of called it with that.
All right, bastards.
I agree with you. It's never going to happen. Never going to happen. We've already crossed the border into Twitter town, and we are not turning around. It is little tweets all the way down at this point.
Elliot, has Disney commissioned a Twitter land yet?
A Twitter land?
Are they going to replace Toontown with it?
Oh, I'm sure that there's something in the works for it. but seriously though, like, this is the new face of journalism. I mean, this is how, and it can be a really good thing. I mean, when protests started going on in Iran a couple of years ago, it was the citizens with their Twitter accounts taking videos and posting them on social media. I mean, that's what got the word out, because the regimes were trying to keep a lid on the truth. And it can be a really powerful thing to have this kind of citizen journalism, social media journalism. I think this is just the new frontier, especially right now. I mean, our journalism nowadays, and not just in regards to politics, but with this Rolling Stone scandal that's been going on at UVA, and there's just, journalism is really, really suffering right now. This is the new age. This is the new journalism.
So then do we need more people like Mike Pereira, who are experts, who just tell people to shut the fuck up when they're being stupid? And when they're not, they can say, oh, yeah, that's valid. Go talk about that.
Yeah.
We need more experts, but we also need a better working knowledge of how to evaluate experts, especially in the era where people can just say, I'm an expert. But
can we just contest Mike Pereira? Just be like, if you're like Mike Pereira, you're an expert. If you're not, you're not. Get out of here.
Just two circles in that Venn diagram.
Yeah.
And with Mike Pereira being the only one in the middle.
Yeah. He's the arbiter. He does, remember when they did that campaign for, the something is now diamonds for Old Spice? When the guy, for a day, he just made social media videos, YouTube videos, replying to people on Twitter. Can we just have Mike Pereira do that for the rest of his life? And just be like, I've never heard something so ridiculous. Beth is dead. You don't need a petition.
In the pantheon of the midside for Justin, we now have Zack Snyder, Christopher Nolan, Bill Belichick, and we can add Mike Pereira to it now.
No, hold on. I just think he made one funny video. Let's be serious. Let's not put him on a Futurama thing yet.
On his way up. I want to contest one point before we move on in the news, which is that much like we have this sort of psychological thing about a golden era in time, like in the United States, and that time is usually some time ago, though undefined. I don't think there ever was a golden era in journalism, really. I think journalism has always been a pretty effing partisan, hacky sort of thing. I mean, there's even a phrase that you learn when you're learning how to do journalism in college called New York Times journalism.
Oh, I thought you were going to say yellow journalism.
No, there is yellow journalism. That's a famous one. But this one is New York Times journalism, where you basically publish whatever it is that you want to publish on the front page, even if it's undersourced and completely biased. And then 2 days later, you publish a retraction on page C37 in the Metro section in a little tiny box that no one will ever see. But you can say, well, oh, we published a retraction, so we're being fair.
Yeah.
Yeah, I wasn't saying that there ever was a golden age of journalism. I'm just telling people to stop being stupid.
But a lot of people think that there was a golden age of journalism, and there really wasn't.
A lot of people are stupid.
But let me ask
that
you
is
guys
what this whole segment was about. Isn't that what this segment's about right now?
Isn't that the theme of the show?
Let me ask you guys something really quick, though. Do you think that the issue is, do we need to focus less on impartiality and focus more on accuracy of details? Is it really important that journalists that we don't know what their leanings are? I mean, if you look at something like the Objective Standard, Reason Magazine, even the now defunct TNR, I mean, you kind of knew where these guys were coming from politically, but is it really that important that we don't know and that they just be, or that they, maybe we can know what their political leanings are, but maybe as long as they're accurate with the facts or with their representation, even if we don't agree with the interpretation of it? Do you think that one is more important than the other?
I'm going to quote my father here. I was originally going to be a journalism major at Ithaca College when I went, and he gave me a copy of Bias by Bernard Goldberg.
Goldberg, yeah.
Right, that was big at the time I was going to go into college. And in it he wrote, we can never escape bias. The best we can do is attempt true honesty. And I think that that answers your question, because being truly honest is saying, this is what I believe, everyone knows it, and then I'm just going to write about reality as I see it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, objectivity, I mean, necessarily a reporter can't know sort of directly what happened. They're reporting after the fact, unless they were an eyewitness. That's different, but that's usually not the case. And I think you nailed it when you said the most important thing is accuracy of facts. Don't use straw men. Don't use misleading terminology. Try your best not to define a thing as you think it should be defined, but as the person who's doing it. I'm thinking mostly of, for instance, like Ayn Rand's ideas. And don't use, you know, it's a lot of things like, just don't use false qualifiers. Like Ayn Rand was once referred to as Nazi era author Ayn Rand.
Ugh.
And it's like,
right. I don't care. I don't care if you don't like Ayn Rand, but don't add something in like that. That has nothing to do with if
you
don't like
Ayn Rand. So was Winston Churchill.
Right.
Nazi era author Winston Churchill.
So was everyone who beat the Nazis. They were Nazi era.
Exactly.
Yep. So were the Jews. The Nazi era Jews.
All right. Let's move on to happier topics like Wonder Woman.
Woohoo!
And Zack Snyder.
Yeah.
Snyder be praised.
Hail Snydra.
That was Elliot, by the way. Yes, Hail Snydra.
I stole that from Daniel from last week, though, so I can't take credit.
So, first of all, I'm reporting from a website that is batman-news.com. I don't know where Justin finds this shit. I couldn't get this on, like, the Associated Press. Justin, I have to report it from batman-news.com.
You haven't learned that nobody reports on Zack Snyder.
This is... This website has a hyphen in the URL. It can't be trusted.
To get information,
says the guy
about
who works for an organization with a hyphen in the URL. Okay, so the story here, moving out of the story and not critiquing the meta part of it. Zack Snyder is going to produce Wonder Woman, the movie, and Michelle McLaren signs on to direct. Michelle McLaren was of Breaking Bad fame. And she is going to direct Gal Gadot in the 2017 Wonder Woman movie. Zack Snyder and his wife, along with Charles Roven, will be the producers. Of course, Batman vs. Superman Dawn of Justice features Gal Gadot, and that will be out in 2016.
So didn't Michelle McLaren do Ozymandias, the episode of Breaking Bad that everyone loves?
I think so. I think that's why she became famous, yeah. Is that all you got on that?
No, I just wanted to clarify that about her.
Okay.
This is what I have on this. I'm done with Marvel.
I thought you were done with Marvel. I thought you've been done with Marvel.
No, this is the nail in the coffin because this is a bigger story than you realize.
Oh.
So
it is.
Zack Snyder was given the keys to Justice League, right? Batman, Superman, he did Man of Steel. But now they're basically saying you're in charge of our entire cinematic universe. So they've basically made him the opposite point to Joss Whedon.
Oh, that's interesting. That's a good way to think about it.
Which is kind of actually really cool if you think about it, because they're both really talented romanticists, but they have the opposite philosophical underpinnings.
Hmm. Yeah, Whedon versus Snyder.
And I have to pick a side, and I have to pick Snyder. Hail Snydra. I have to do it. I mean... And did you see Jason Momoa, or however you say his name, Khal Drogo, came out and said he wants Zack Snyder to do Aquaman 2. Not
yeah,
the sequel,
I saw
but
that.
Aquaman as well.
Yes. Let's not get ahead of ourselves. Yeah, I think if there's going to be one person who can actually make fucking Aquaman interesting, it would be Zack Snyder.
Can he possibly direct every DC movie? Does he have the time?
Let's just line it up. Let's just put him on retainer. Or yeah. What's that called when someone has a holding deal or a development deal?
Yeah.
DC give them a development deal. You just sit here and do everything that we tell you, and here's your buko millions of dollars.
What's the DC equivalent of S.H.I.E.L.D.?
The DC equivalent of S.H.I.E.L.D., the Justice League?
No, the Justice League's like the Avengers.
Right.
S.H.I.E.L.D. is the
No. You're right. What am I thinking of?
All right, someone that they passed the Suicide Squad, or that they're gonna...
Yeah, they're going to do Suicide Squad as well, with a bunch of villains in there, with Jared Leto replacing Heath Ledger. But this is what I want to know about the S.H.I.E.L.D. thing. Zack Snyder, call me up, we will do members of whatever that group is, and we will destroy Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. and make a better show.
Oh, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. is a good show.
I'm not ready to watch that on Marvel completely,
okay. But that's only because I haven't seen Age of Ultron. If it's true that they are going to make Tony Stark a bad guy, then I'm done.
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to watch Age of Ultron. I'm going to watch Captain America 3 because they have Iron Man in it, and I will support Iron Man. But
if they do make him a villain, I'm not going to do it anymore. I'm going to go gulp.
Maybe it'll be the first movie I walk out of. No, I won't walk out of it because I want to see what they're going to do with it. But the point is, they're all in on Snyder now, right?
Yeah.
Not only are they all in on Snyder, we're going to talk about who's going to make the first female action hero movie. We've got Wonder Woman, female superhero movie. We've got Wonder Woman with a female writer-director and Zack Snyder producing, who, by the way, made the Eyelash movie, a.k.a. Sucker Punch, which is all about empowering women. I know people don't think that, but that's what Sucker Punch is all about. So I love this, but of course you would have expected that.
I haven't seen Sucker Punch, so I'm looking forward to it. I know. Steven.
Justin just had a minor heart attack.
I will watch it. I do want to watch it. I haven't seen it yet.
All right. So we had to do a Zack Snyder story to really prepare us for this next story.
Well, it's women empowerment, huge, right?
That's a theme, but really just the subject matter is an enormous step down from Zack Snyder. And if we had come off this directly from talking about like the Broncos, it would have been slitting our wrist time. Lena Dunham is who we're going to talk about. Probably the most frustratingly horrible celebrity alive at the moment, in my opinion.
So what you're saying is, if we went from the Broncos to Lena Dunham, we would have just been talking about a lot of things that resemble horses.
Yeah, there's a lot of that. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And who also... Yeah, well, never mind. So, in Lena Dunham's book, which I'm sure all of you have read, and if you haven't, good, don't. She accuses a college Republican in the book, who she names Barry One, of raping her while she was in college, though she provides no, you know, evidence for this claim. So the man identified as Barry One in this book is now considering a libel suit against Lena Dunham. And in fact, he is raising money to pay for his legal funds, which he says 100% of which will either be used to pay for the legal funds, and if there's any left over, it will go to a nonprofit organization that aids sexual assault victims.
Okay.
Anyone? Lena Dunham? Fans?
I have a few things. One, I didn't even know she had accused someone of rape, so this is all news to me. I didn't know about any of this until you sent me the story.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Two, I was really confused because it says Barry One, and Obama is sometimes called Barry Sotero or whatever, and I'm like, what is going on right now? Because it's on Breitbart. So I didn't know what was going on. And then finally, here's my serious point. Why would you ever falsely accuse someone of rape? Does no one understand how serious of an allegation that is?
No, she doesn't. She doesn't. I mean, this is the same girl who wrote about basically, like, sexually exploiting her little sister and did not think that that was going to raise any flags whatsoever.
It's a matter of, one, not thinking how bad it is, but two, also having this narcissistic belief that no one would ever call her out on it. I don't think that's just Lena Dunham, although she has been our narcissist of the week, and she is one of the most narcissistic people in Hollywood.
She was our first narcissist of the week.
Yes, inaugural. She was the
inaugural narcissist of the week. Yes. So I just honestly think if she made this up, and the burden of proof is on her, right? You can't, everyone is innocent until proven guilty. She just assumed people would take her word for it because she's fucking Lena Dunham and she's a progressive. And everyone gets raped in college, right? They're just giant rape factories. Women are just getting raped left and right in class, you know, at the fraternity houses, in the School of Music, behind the bushes over there.
Now you're going into our next story.
I'm setting us up. Yeah. So I just think she honestly didn't think anyone would ask. And because, again, to tie us back to our first story, when have journalists ever done their fucking job in the past ever? When have they actually asked questions like, do you have evidence for your claim?
Yes. It's what's going on with the Rolling Stone UVA scandal. These men were accused. I mean, there was accusations and all these feminist reporters like Zerlina Maxwell, Amanda Marcotte, who are writing things along the lines of, well, even if this story is false, we should still believe women. You know, we should absolutely believe women right from the beginning. We should not hold them accountable. We should not try to, I mean, we shouldn't question it. We should just accept it unquestioningly. It's this idea that women who, if you accuse, if a woman accuses a man of rape, that needs to be sacrosanct. It has to be taken on face value. It cannot be questioned. It cannot be put through any kind of rational analysis in order to discern if it's true or not. And that's the culture that's being raised right now in college campuses. And Lena Dunham is the product of this. She is the example of what feminism wants to do to women in the, in colleges all across the country. Now, she is the end result of what they want to accomplish.
Well, yeah, and I think the point you're making about the UVA thing is well taken, because it's just so disconnected from reality. I didn't really know much about that either, but it popped up in my Facebook news feed. I have a friend who's from India, and she pointed out that the claim in the UVA thing was that someone was gang raped, correct?
Yeah.
Right, and she pointed out that in India, a woman was gang raped recently, and she died from it. And then this supposed girl was gang raped at UVA and didn't even go to the hospital.
Yeah.
It doesn't make much sense.
Yeah. Look, and we have to put in this, we don't have to, but I feel compelled by my now deeply rooted feminist beliefs that we have to put in this disclaimer that there are people who are legitimately raped, and those are serious crimes, and they should be dealt with severely by the legal system, and women should be encouraged to speak up about that immediately following those incidents. But it has become an epidemic where you can throw around the word rape or the accusation of rape without any fear of consequence whatsoever, and you're almost held up as a hero for doing so, which is a bizarre kind of way to look at it.
And it hurts women who maybe are being raped and can't talk about it. These kinds of scandals, this diminishes their – this is what disempowers women. When girls come out and falsely accuse men of rape, that diminishes and hurts women who actually have situations that they need to bring to the police or that they need to notify the authorities about. They can't do that because they're hurting those cases.
Yeah. So, and it's important to remember that, keeping this in context with our culture, how powerful a rape accusation is. So I know someone, and it's a mutual acquaintance of Justin and I's, at least. Elliot might be aware, but I'm not going to name this person on the podcast, who was accused of raping someone. And it was sort of high profile because he has quite a bit of money and a little bit of celebrity, though not, I mean, in a certain circle.
I just want to say acquaintance is very strong, because he just happened to be in the same place I was once.
Okay. Well, I didn't know. Anyway, his life for basically 3 months was completely ruined. He was harassed by people. He had speaking engagements canceled. He had jobs canceled. He had all this stuff canceled on an accusation that later the woman recanted and admitted was false. These have serious, deep consequences and need to be taken seriously. And so equally, false accusations need to be, in my opinion, prosecuted as harshly.
Yes, absolutely.
And to give you the transition to the next article, I think the consequences go beyond simply the accusations themselves. I think it's the fear of the accusations and the effect they have on the way we relate to each other and interact with each other.
Primarily speaking, the consequence has been a great sexodus. Now, that's a funny term for something that has actually a potentially very serious problem. Again, turning to Breitbart London, an article by Milo Yiannopoulos. Why do people have names like this? What happened to Steve Smith?
Hey, that is insensitive to people of Eastern European descent, okay?
I am Mr. completely and utterly boring centric when it comes to names. I have one of the most white, boring names on the planet, Daniel Thomas Richards. And thus, I didn't learn to pronounce any other name.
Well, I'm going to give you a little bit of a brief tangent here. Over Thanksgiving, my dad was going on and on about how when he was a kid, he grew up poor, bottom of the barrel ethnically, because he was from a Polish immigrant family. And now when he walks through Gillette Stadium, he sees everyone wearing jerseys of Gostkowski and Gronkowski. So, suck it, Daniel, with your boring, white, Anglo-Saxon names, all right? Gronk Spike.
To the point where he gets emails like the from wrong D. Richards.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't get emails wrong Jay Lesniewski.
You don't get the emails to the right person because they can't spell your name.
Well, that's true.
Anyway, men are giving up on women and checking out of society, according to this
They're
article.
Going gay! Woohoo!
No.
No.
Oh.
No, I'm sorry, Elliot. They're not. No. They're actually going to porn and to video games.
Or nothing.
And to nothing. So I'm going to read the opening paragraph to this because it's fairly powerful. So it begins with a quote. "My generation of boys is fucked," says Rupert, a young German video game enthusiast I've been getting to know over the past few months. "Marriage is dead. Divorce means you're screwed for life. Women have given up on monogamy, which makes them uninteresting to us for any serious relationship or raising a family. That's the way it is. Even if we take the risk, chances are the kids won't be ours. In France, we even have to pay for kids a wife has through adulterous affairs."
Well, that's just France. Fuck France.
So the article basically points out that never before in history, at least according to this author, have the relations between the sexes been so fraught with, quote, anxiety, animosity, and misunderstanding. And the article goes on to say this is due in large part to a radical form of feminism that sort of privileges the female and diminishes the male. And in a lot of ways holds up the female as the standard of what is good and what is right, and says that the man, the male, the boy is rebellious and needs to be controlled, and is, of course, as we talked about in the last story, a rapist and a misogynist, and not to mention, a racist and a bigot, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Has this been your guys' experience? Have you met people who have partaken in the mass sexodus?
Confession time. I was, am, whatever, one of these guys. Although I just want to add the caveat that they put it in here like people are all going to drugs, alcohol, and porn as a way of escaping. I just like watch Highlander every night. That's why I know so much about television. I was like, oh, you know, my roommates and I undergrad, we watched all of Star Trek Enterprise. And then when I lived at home for a year, I watched all of Highlander. So that was what I did instead. But the point is, yeah, I was one of these guys. I basically didn't date from 18 to 28 because I was like, it's not worth it. I didn't understand it until like about 5 years ago when I started realizing it was feminism that did it to me. But I would put in a marginal effort every once in a while, but it was basically just going through the motions as I had no idea what I was doing. I still have no idea what I'm doing because of this. About 70% of the time, in the rare instances that I talk to women I don't have a pre-established relationship with, I can't tell what the interaction between myself and the woman actually is about. I just try to get through it without embarrassing myself or hurting myself.
I actually think that's a huge consequence they point out here, which is that in previous cultures, a man could approach a woman and, you know, show interest and it not be necessarily a detriment on his character. Now, unless the woman is 100% interested in you, your advances are seen as creepy or unwanted or even potentially rape in some universities where, for instance, prolonged staring is considered a form of rape.
Correct. And when I was young, what I was obsessed with, and when I say young, I mean like my 20s, was I was like, how do you know a girl is interested? Like, what are the signs that you can pick out? Because I didn't believe it was right to approach a girl and show interest if she wasn't 100% interested. I was waiting for that. I mean, I can think back now to situations where I just completely left the opportunity on the table because I wasn't even aware the opportunity was there because I was looking for a guarantee because I was afraid of what would happen. I literally had a fear of getting slapped. People were like, well, what's going to happen? I was like, I'm going to get slapped. They're like, why would you get slapped? Because I literally believed it was inappropriate. Now, thankfully, I have a girlfriend now, so I don't have to worry about most of this. But the point is, it's affected my character and the way I interact with people. And I did lose 10 years of my life, this part of my life that I never learned about and I don't have knowledge about. And if I have kids, how do I pass it down to my kids?
Yeah, that's a good point. I never thought about the having kids element of it. But
it's inconceivable that Justin would have children. Is that what you're saying, Daniel?
Well, I mean, that is part of it, too. Do I really want to bring kids into this?
Little angry Bostonian kids running around. kicking everything.
They just always wear Patriots jerseys all the time. Mm-hmm. They're named Brady, Brady 2, Brady 3.
Why is your daughter's name Belichick?
No, her name is Bella.
Bella.
Her middle name is Check.
Bella Check Lesneski.
There you go. Yes. Oh, I like God. That.
Oh, shut it.
Great.
Okay.
It's great.
Oh, God. So this has had a pretty detrimental effect on male culture, at least according to these articles. And it's resulting in men withdrawing basically their entire, you might say sanction, but basically everything from this part. They're retreating to sort of rowdy behavior with other men. They're retreating to drinking and drugs, as you alluded to. But they're also retreating to pornography and bizarre fetish kind of things.
Or watching Highlander.
This is something that Adam Carolla actually points out on his show, which is there's so much available now. And he says when he was younger, if he wanted to see a boob, he had to go out and get someone drunk and convince them to go home with him, which is now considered rape, by the way. But now you could have the most bizarre, obscure fetish in the world, and you can find it somewhere on the internet.
Or how about this? Like when I was an undergrad, I could just go on Facebook and like see the pictures of all the girls. Why would I need to go out and talk to them if there was no difference between looking at them in public or looking at their picture on Facebook?
Okay, I need to say something that's going to be unpopular. So get Woo-hoo. Ready. Okay.
With us or with the audience?
Probably everybody. So burn me an FG when I'm done. Okay, but he brought up Adam Carolla. I know this is going to be hard to say, but Adam Carolla has to take his share of the blame for it too. And this is what I mean. It's feminism has pretty much crippled men in our society in so many ways. But I think that there is a certain argument that can be made where some of the men in the culture have done this too. Now, Carolla, back in the day, he and Kimmel hosted The Man Show, which was kind of this roughhouse, you know, man drink beer and boobs kind of thing. You know, that was extremely popular. But I remember even I growing up as a little gay lad here in Orlando, I didn't relate to that. I'm like, no, that's not a man. Like when I look at my father, that's not my father. You know, or anybody that I know in person, I didn't understand this abstraction of this idea that men were supposed to do this. And I think that there is a certain element of popular culture where men have allowed this to happen because, I mean, the movies like Dumb and Dumber and Dumb and Dumber 2, regardless of whether the movies are good or not, this is the kind of image of men that has been concretized throughout the culture, through movies and television shows. We laugh with the stupid guy comedies, the dumb guy, leads, even the romantic leads of films nowadays are hapless guys who succeed because they're lucky, not because they're thinking individuals. So I think that in a certain sense, there are some men within popular culture that have opened the door for feminists to completely whittle away men's masculinity in this fashion.
I think you're exactly right with what you said, but I want to distinguish between two things. There's one we were talking about where people are reinforcing the idea of the dumb male lead. I think that's different from what someone like Adam Carolla or Bill Burr is doing, because I see them as sort of the same thing. And what I'm talking about is I think they're more reactionary. I think The Man Show is more reactionary. That doesn't make it any better, but what I'm saying is it's trying to reclaim manhood and trying to say we're men and we have nothing to be embarrassed about. But the error they're making is what you're pointing out is they're playing into the stereotype of what men are supposed to be by doing that.
Yeah, so The Man Show was a creation. It's basically the anti-View is what it was supposed to be. The View came out and it was so widely accepted as, oh, this is real women being real in this space where they can be free to talk. And, well, you men, shut up over there, sit down, do what we say. And he was like, fuck that, basically. We're going to say what we want as well. So they wanted a male The View.
Right, but
basically.
Then they just played into the stereotypes.
I agree. No, I agree with that part.
Right.
But.
And this is actually the concretization that Elliot's talking about. This plays into something from the article, a quote I want to read from the article. And it's something I've dealt with my entire life. And it's actually even affected my self-image. So it says, men say the gap between what women say and what they do has never been wider. Men are constantly told they should be delicate, sensitive fellow travelers on the feminist path. But the same women who say they want a nice, unthreatening boyfriend go home and swoon over simple-minded, giant-chested, testosterone-saturated hunks in Game of Thrones. Men know this, and for some, this giant inconsistency makes the whole game look too much like hard work. That is something I definitely dealt with. Now, this person's being a little bit over the top with the extremes, but the extremes are being done in a romantic way, artistically, to make a point about this. I definitely dealt with this a lot when I was younger, in high school and in undergrad, and it just made me not want to try. Because they would say they would want certain things, and then look for the opposite, and then get hurt with it, and then keep doing the same thing. Like rats keep touching the electrified fence over and over again. And over my life, I've come to concretize this as the Thor-Iron Man dichotomy, where it shouldn't be a dichotomy at all, where who do we see and hold up as attractive, physically, as a man? Who's supposed to be the attractive one? Thor. Well,
to use your example, Chris Hemsworth, yeah.
Chris Hemsworth was just named the sexiest man alive, right? Am I imagining that?
No, he was.
I think, yeah.
Right, which is entirely my point. But does anyone ever talk about how hot Robert Downey Jr. as Tony Stark is?
I do.
Okay, well, that was what I was going to ask you, Elliot. Is he attractive?
Yes.
But he's a completely different physical type than Thor, correct?
Yeah, but I think that, and I'm sure this is probably where you're going, but I think it's the integration of who he is, in terms of what he's accomplished in terms of his intelligence, and of course, the application of that intelligence to his circumstances and his sense of humor, obviously.
Right.
I think all of
that
integrates into a really attractive person.
Right. So there's a difference between being physically fit and then who you are integrated as a person and how that fits into your life. Different people have different places that the type of working out they do and the type of physical appearance they play has to do with their life. In the same sense, the genetic plays a role too. So the idea that, you know, this one type is attractive, you know, we talk about the issues women have with this, but all they're doing, and this is what I say all the time about these minority groups trying to rise up and make things equal. They're not trying to make things equal. They're just trying, now feminists are trying to oppress men as much as they're oppressed, and they're trying to give the same issues back to men. Did the movie stars back in the day look like Chris Hemsworth? Were they all jacked out of their mind like that?
Oh, you had Humphrey Bogart, that sexy-ass mofo. Ooh, Humphrey Bogart with that cigar. Oh, let me tell you. Sexy.
Oh, my. This podcast is going in a direction I didn't expect.
Really? I kind of was hoping Elliot would act like this because it drives the point home.
But am I wrong? You see, like, I mean, who do you think?
I have no idea. I'm straight. I can't tell if a man's attractive. That's part of the reason why it's confusing for me.
How do I know? But you look at somebody like, who's really big right now? Let's say Anna Kendrick. Very talented, pretty, but put her against Marilyn Monroe. Come on.
But
that's a personality,
Elliot,
thing.
Also, you have to realize that we're not allowed to make that kind of judgment. When we hold up as straight men, sort of what you would consider a Marilyn Monroe type person, a very voluptuous kind of beauty, we're being stereotypical and objectifying her. We need to find women, we're told over and over again, like Lena Dunham, attractive. When in fact, I want to hit her in the face with a shovel.
She already
doesn't
looks
need like to be hit in the face with a shovel again.
It would be an improvement. Mostly would make me feel better and would improve my mood.
We are so going to get called out for this podcast one of these days.
Oh, we're not going to really hit Lena Dunham in the face with a shovel. We're back over her with a car. But regardless.
Like this heterosexual, waspy male, conservative males want to attack Lena Dunham. And here's the audio.
Okay. I'm never running for public office. But
I mean, considering everything she's done, I don't really care if people think I want to attack her.
Alas.
All right, let's move on.
Anything else about this article? I mean, it's generally depressing to me. So the one other point they do admit before we get lots of hate mail about this is that it's not to say that there's some dearth of sex on college campuses. There's a lot of sex going on. But their point is that men aren't particularly interested in relationships at all. They are completely fine with Tinder and OkCupid and just hooking up.
Yeah, I was probably an extreme weirdo that I literally did nothing.
No, I mean, I think that's probably a significant portion, if not a plurality or a majority. But
thanks for making me feel better.
No, you're not a total loser. Just saying.
Can we move on to a woman who's awesome? Can we talk about Katniss?
All right. That will make me feel a little better, I think.
Maybe. Until you quote Grantland.
From our arch nemesis, Grantland, I bring you a review. A review of Hunger Games Mockingjay Part 1. Wesley Morris writes, there are cliffhangers, and then there's what happens in the third and next to last Hunger Games installment, Mockingjay Part 1. We don't even get to the cliff. Just as the revolution against the Capitol is about to get good, here come the closing credits with a brand new dirge from the movie's soundtrack curator, Lord. Yes, the reward for watching Katniss Everdeen tour one bombed out district after the next, for seeing her weep and mule for Pile of the Dead, and for her poor pretend paramour PETA. This is the most pretentious writing I've ever read, by the way. Is having to wait to see what it builds to. So much skill and craftsmanship and good writing and acting and costuming and production design going to this movie, that it feels churlish to respond with resentment, but it's possible, perhaps even necessary, to enjoy the movie and despise how abruptly it ends.
I am glad you picked out this quote, because this is exactly the quote that encapsulates what is wrong with this review and encapsulates Grantland.
Shitty writing, not thinking through things.
Yes, not even understanding the movie you watched. This is just like their stupid review of The Walking Dead Season 2 when they said nothing was happening. All right.
Or everybody's review of Interstellar.
Yes, it's the same exact mentality for the review of Interstellar. Very true, Elliot. Very good point. So they're saying we have to wait to see what it builds up to. It built towards rescuing PETA and finding out he had been brainwashed or whatever the fuck they call it. I don't know, tracker jacked or hijacked or whatever their terminology is.
Tracker jacked? Yeah.
That was the climax of the movie. Notice how that was what was going on. They were all going into the Capitol, coming out. It was very tense. And then the end of the movie was, oh my God, what's going to happen? She can't trust PETA anymore, when PETA was who she had trusted over the first two movies. The movie wasn't about war. It was about the build-up to war.
They hit the audience over the head with that. It was a constant parallel between the use of Katniss for District 13 and the use of PETA for the Capitol. Back and forth as his deterioration happens on screen and her sort of mental anxiety continues inside the bunker.
Right, but she got stronger and he got weaker.
Yes, yes, absolutely. And then with the climax being the rescue, how is that? How did Grantland not understand that? Or are they willfully evading?
I think they're willfully evading because they're not the only people saying this. This was the third book that was broken up into two movies. And they broke it up beautifully. This was an enclosed story. This was an enclosed story about what happened to Katniss and PETA after the 75th Hunger Games. And it was about the build-up to war. This was not about war. This was about the build-up to war. And the Hunger Games aren't even about war. They're about what war does to Katniss. And this was the next chapter in what it did to Katniss. And you were exactly right in what you're saying about the concretization. That's what made this such a good movie. It concretized in Katniss and in PETA the different ways the Capitol is destroying these two powerful young people. A rational person... Two rational people are being destroyed in different ways by the Capitol. And it really had us experience that and see it. And see the choices she was making to try and overcome it and fight for her values.
Yes, and I think this, of all the movies, was definitely the one in which you see Katniss taking charge. And Katniss making long, value-based decisions. Long-range, value-based decisions.
Yeah, they finally figured it out.
Especially in the movie in the first movie, you see almost none of this and it's completely reactionary and she's just basically bounced around by her circumstances and it becomes insanely naturalistic in that regard.
Right, that's why the Hunger Games in the first movie was decent until they got to the actual games, but the games were really poorly done because they were just naturalistic. As you said, Katniss was just reacting. Whereas with here, the director, and by the way, this is a new director, if you notice, Movie 2 and Movie 3 were better than Movie 1 because Francis Lawrence took over. But in this one, the director, you could really tell, he figured out how to visually concretize her making the decisions. What she's paying attention to, the way the scenery is affecting her and reflecting her.
Yeah. There is a line in this review that to me encapsulates its nihilism. And I do believe this is a nihilistic review of a movie. And I do believe most of what Grantland produces is nihilistic. It's basically out to destroy. It's not out to build up at all. And so there's a scene at the end, or not at the end, there's a scene in the movie that is particularly touching, where Effie says to Katniss, everything old can be made new again, like democracy. And this is what Grantland writes about it. It's a touchingly wishful thought from someone dressed like one of the Beale women from Grey Gardens. Go to hell, Grantland, and go to hell and die, along with Lena Dunham. It is a completely touching moment that you don't need to trash by making a one-off stupid comment about her outfit that is completely non-essential.
Yeah, I think that shows that they're threatened by the movie, because the movie is a powerful statement for young women. It's a powerful statement to use your mind and stand up for your values. Katniss is you want to talk about strong heroines, and we'll get into that later in Yahoo Answers, but you want to talk about strong women? Strong action heroes?
Yeah. Quite.
Nobody even saw Grey Gardens, so they wasted that reference.
It's like Dan said, Daniel said, it's very pretentious. It's a pretentious reference.
Yeah, I mean, I'm gay, and I didn't watch Grey Gardens. If I didn't watch it, then...
If Elliot didn't watch Grey Gardens, nobody did.
Nobody watched Grey Gardens. Grey Gardens.
Gay Grey Gardens.
Gay Gardens.
So yeah, fuck cool. You, Grantland. Go to hell.
Speaking of not watching anything, The Walking Dead is in its mid-season break. Doctor Who is idling until Christmas. We need something new to watch. Elliot reviews the premiere of The Librarians next in TV with AML.
Focused on. All right, you guys. So on Sunday night, there was the premiere of The Librarians. It was on TNT, and it was from the same team that did Leverage. You had John Rogers, you had Dean Devlin directing. And remind me to tell you at the end, by the way, a very fun story about John Rogers and why he blocked me on Twitter. But first, the show itself is a very fun, lighthearted show. The premise of it is that if you've seen the Librarian movies with Noah Wiley, and it's got some, you know, recurring characters if you've watched those movies, he's a librarian who goes around the world collecting magical artifacts that they put into the library, and he finds them, brings them back, and he helps to kind of keep them safe and hide them away from the world. If that premise sounds very familiar to you, it's because it was used a little bit more effectively in Warehouse 13. In fact, that's Warehouse 13, I think, is actually a better show than this one. But this one is not bad. It's fun. It's very adventurous. It's a little Indiana Jones mixed with Warehouse 13, mixed with I actually told Justin that it's mixed a little bit with the 11th Doctor, because Noah Wiley, who plays the librarian, the title character in the films, he comes out in the premiere, even though he's not going to really be around for the series. And when you watch the episode, you'll see why. But he has a lot of 11th Doctor moments in how he reacts to situations and reacts to things. So somebody's a Whovian on that writing staff or in the direction. It's interesting because it has, the premiere at least has themes of magic versus technology, that the world was once filled with magic. And then as technology grew, magic began to fade away, which you can interpret in different ways. You know, for example, as science and reason advance, then mysticism begins to dwindle, or you could look at it the other obvious way as well. But interestingly, and I won't go into details, but the solution to the problem set up in the premiere is, the solution is a technological one, not a magical one. They have to use technology, not science, in order to fix the situation. So definitely, it was a lot of fun. I have to tell you this story because I promised I would. John Rogers was also the creator and the executive producer of Leverage. And last year, he had done an episode of Leverage basically taking a pot shot at Walmart. and he did the typical, you know, big, you know, the big box stores, and they're pushing out the business of the little guy, and the team has to go after the box store, and it was just, it was probably one of their worst episodes ever for so many reasons. Well, I don't necessarily remember the reason why this exchange happened, but I tweeted some, I tweeted at him, you know, something, oh, I don't even remember what it was, but he tweeted back, I'm blocking you because you block, you're blocked for living in an Ayn Rand fantasy world was his tweet to me. And so I'm like, okay, sure. Ayn Rand's fantasy world, the world, you know, she holds objective reality, but sure, it's a fantasy world, whatever you say, Rogers. So, you know, I try not to let that color my judgment of things. But that's neither here nor there. The show itself is fun. It's entertaining. It's not as good as Warehouse 13. I think Warehouse 13 really had a little bit more, a little more sympathy for the characters. And we were talking about that last night, Justin, in another context, but sympathy for characters, characters that we liked, that we were really interested in seeing them grow. And, this one, I think that you meet the characters a little too quickly. The archetypes are very well established, but they don't really, they're just kind of thrown into a story. They're not really given a chance to kind of shine through. So maybe as the series goes on, you'll see that more. But it is fun. I keep saying that word. It's a lot of fun to watch. It's probably going to be a guilty pleasure, but I don't think it's going to really be like Emmy material anytime soon.
Warehouse 13 had Allison Scagliotti. That was the difference.
Oh, she was amazing. I love that woman.
Yes,
oh.
She was amazing.
She was amazing.
I'm not objectifying. Not no, objectifying.
No, talent-wise, she was amazing.
Yeah, she was also gorgeous.
Yeah, well, she had giant talent.
No, they're not giant.
I don't know who we're talking about. I'm just being objectifying.
Claudia. You never saw Warehouse 13?
Not a single millisecond.
Daniel, I don't know what's wrong with you.
I'm not interested in warehouses and librarians.
What are you interested in?
Eaten alive by an anaconda.
Did the anaconda not want him because he didn't have buns, hun?
Oh, wow. I hope you pre-wrote that joke.
No, actually, I just came up with it right
now.
Oh, wow.
Oh, man. The show Eaten Alive, which aired on the Discovery Network, promised to have Paul Rosalie consumed by an anaconda in a Sunday night special. In fact, the show was aptly titled Eaten Alive, but it's viewers were outraged by the fact that he wasn't actually eaten alive. Yes, I know, that's ridiculous. But apparently, the snake wrapped around him, started to eat his helmet, and then he immediately called for help because his hand was being crushed, and then it was over.
Ah!
So was this just a failed stunt? Is that what this is?
Failed stunt. There were some great tweets that were generated by it from at Reagan Kingley's. Said, calling it Eaten Alive is like having a show on the Food Network about cooking a turkey, and all they do after 2 hours is preheat the oven.
Mm-hmm.
At TD_B Delensky said, Paul Rosalie didn't need an anaconda. He's getting eaten alive quite well by the Twitters. And then, of course, at It's Jess Tucker had the obligatory, this guy had one job, literally one fucking job, to get eaten alive, and he fucked it up.
So these are the 50 people who got bored with the Broncos-Bills controversy and moved on to this on Sunday night?
Yes. This story in the TV section, because I thought it was hysterical that Eaten Alive guy did not get eaten alive. Not that we expected him to be eaten alive, really. But, you know, as a schadenfreude culture, we were sort of like, maybe he will.
All right, let's move on to more serious articles here. And in our ongoing battle against naturalism and our ongoing battle against feminism, this fits in quite well with the theme of the episode. On BuzzFeed,
and our ongoing battle against stupidity on Twitter.
Yeah, it all works together, right?
This is the perfect mid-side story.
It is, all because of my instigating. But on BuzzFeed, which is always the warning sign right there, there is an article by Ariane Lang called 12 Female Characters Who 12 Female Characters Who Keep Shaving Despite Constant Peril. And then the sub title here is, just because you live in fear for your life doesn't mean you let yourself go, ladies. So then, this is the paragraph it has. I'm about to tell you something shocking. Most women grow hair in their armpits. Super gross, right? It takes effort to stay hairless. That being said, if you're a woman who's ever packed an emergency end-of-the-world kit, you might have thought to yourself, well, I'm living in constant peril. I probably will not prioritize keeping my armpits shaved. But that would be a total cop-out, fellow women, because you can shave during an apocalypse, and you should. These brave female characters are survivors of catastrophe who inspire us all to keep shaving, even against the odds. And it has Ginger from Gilligan's Island, Marianne from Gilligan's Island, Nova from Planet of the Apes, Ripley from Alien, character from The Blue Lagoon, Belle from Beauty and the Beast, because apparently that's a post-apocalyptic drama. Helen from Waterworld, because anyone took that movie serious about anything. Kate from Lost. And they're pointing to the sex scene of her in the cage, because that sex scene would have been so hot if she had hairy armpits. Oh my god. Evie from V for Vendetta, because if you shave your head, you shouldn't also shave your armpits. Katniss Everdeen. She's taking Katniss to task. After we just talked about how strong Katniss is, she's not good enough. Triss from Divergent, who's like...
That's, of all of these, that's the stupidest one to me, by the way.
That one?
I mean, yeah. The whole, one of the entire points of the Hunger Games is that it's glamorous. They keep them well, fed, well, you know, dressed. Preening is one of the entire points of the Hunger Games.
All right, well, the last stupid one is All Women, The Walking Dead. So, ignoring the fact that these women all have downtime to which they could shave their armpits, because that's falling into the naturalistic argument where you're arguing about the logic of it, right?
Yeah.
Right. Isn't this an example of them wanting naturalism over romanticism and saying because it's not naturalism, it's oppressive to women?
This reminds me of people who used to complain about 24. Like, how come you never see Jack Bauer in the bathroom? I'm like, do you want to watch Jack Bauer taking a shit on the John? I mean, is that really what you want to see on screen, or do you want to see him kicking some terrorist ass?
Right, and that's
the
point.
This is what this reminds me of.
Right.
I think some people do want to see him shit, actually. And not just, like, the German Scheisse fetishists. Like, I really think that there are more naturalists who think that it's not good unless you're showing the gritty, underbelly reality of the thing.
I'm sorry,
which
but,
is
I
insane.
Mean, nobody wants to see... I do not know any sane person who wants to see Jack Bauer on the shitter in a show about counterterrorism. I mean, you have to be really a hardcore naturalist to want this. But I remember that's... Oh, I used to drive me nuts. How can we never see them in the bathroom? Because there's terrorists blowing shit up. And they don't have...
Have you seen Orange is the New Black?
You literally do see her on the toilet in the first episode.
Yuck.
Indeed.
Glad I didn't watch it.
Absolutely.
This
is definitely an example of naturalism taken as a premise.
Gross.
The point of art is not to recreate reality verbatim. Art is not documentary, right? And even documentary is not recreating verbatim. Everything is a choice. Art has a conceptual meaning, and you're supposed to remove things that distract from that conceptual meaning, ultimately. So, who is this woman?
All right, her name is Ariane Lang, and she's an editor of some sort on BuzzFeed. And I actually had a Twitter interaction with her, because I'm on my zombie account for the web series, How to Survive the Zombie Apocalypse, and I respond to people who say things about The Walking Dead or zombie movies or just the zombie apocalypse in general. And this woman, random woman, I won't say her name because there's no need to drag her into this, but she said, shaving is a top priority. Hashtag zombie, hashtag apocalypse, and link to the article. So I replied, it's art. It's not meant to be 100% realistic. Right? Which is just basically saying, question your premise about naturalism. Make sense?
Mm-hmm.
This woman replied, I like realism with my gore, which is kind of like a sarcastic, snotty reply. But then the writer of the article found this tweet, right? I did not seek her out, and this is what she replied. Even if it's art, isn't that more cause not to unthinkingly reproduce the, in this case, sexist values of society?
It's a sexist value for
right,
women
because
to shave their armpits?
We're saying there's one modality of women's beauty, and if they don't do that. And I'd just like to point out, as a counterpoint to this, Rick's beard is immaculately groomed in this season of The Walking Dead. Like, it's this full-on bushy beard that looks like it's styled every episode. So I would just like to point that out. That
yes, all men.
Correct. So I replied, it's an assumption to say the production team did it unthinkingly. I mean, to break away from my tweet. Isn't that fair to say? I mean, don't you assume that the production team of The Walking Dead or any of these major motion pictures did everything intentionally?
You mean the people that they pay thousands, hundreds of thousands, possibly millions of dollars to make sure that the set is correct, that the costumes are correct, all the continuity people? You mean, did they spend the money to ensure that things were going to look well for the story? I mean, that's how I would look at it. I would never assume that they just put shit on the screen, just, you know,
I can't even speak
right now. She pissed me off.
This is something too where, you know, they're telling certain actors and actresses to cut or not cut their hair to keep continuity over a season. So it has to be something that they think about and address.
Right. Where I'm sure they had that discussion. We could do that, but do we really want to have people look at that the whole time? Right. Even in Survivor, right, they make the people look prettier in post-production. Right, they whiten all their teeth in post-production because nobody wants to look at unbrushed teeth for 39 days.
Right.
So I also replied, also not sure how it's sexist. So this is the coup de grace of responses. She says, okay, goofball. Now, this pisses me off and offends me. If she had just said, you're an asshole, I wouldn't have cared. But to thinly veil it as if I'm not intelligent enough to understand that she's calling me an asshole simply because I voiced a different opinion and she doesn't have the balls to say it flat out, is ridiculous. So I replied, so no replies to our points then, just the thinly veiled profane name-calling insult? To which she replied, LOL at goofball plus profane in the same sentence. And no, since you didn't understand my point, I have no reply. Bye. And I said, we're not stupid, Miss Lang. Goofball is a clear substitute for asshole, but nice evasion again. So this is my response, Miss Lang. If you really think we don't understand your point, you're welcome to come on this podcast and discuss it with us. And I will prove to you that I understood your point and that your point is wrong and that calling someone another name in place of another name doesn't make you smart or clever. It makes you a pretentious douchebag who thinks they're superior to somebody else.
Douchebag, that's oppressive. I feel oppressed.
That's sexist.
Fine, it makes you a pretentious goofball that thinks they're superior to other people, that thinks they're superior to other people. So come on the podcast and prove to us that we do not understand your point. Prove it to us.
Or maybe she's the one who doesn't understand her point and we understand it all too well. Ooh!
That's what I think it is. She didn't know how to argue with it, so she did the juvenile tactic of, well, you don't understand me. Which makes you look bad, because if you reply, but I do understand, then you're automatically on the defensive.
She's likely never heard anyone say that something she thinks is sexist is in fact not sexist.
Yeah.
And I honestly mean that. She probably has never encountered that in her entire existence.
Let's address, though, the first girl that you were, the first person that you interacted with, who talked about realism with the blood and guts and gore. I really need to do that table between fantasy and realism and naturalism and romanticism and how, you know, just you can have realism and still have it be romantic. It doesn't necessarily mean naturalism. Realism and naturalism are not interchangeable terms.
Right.
Yes, that would be an interesting graphic.
Greed.
All right. So let's keep this discussion of women in television and movies going with the insights that can only be found in Yahoo Answers Answers. Just another answer, I won't pick it. And just another question. Just another answer, I won't pick it. First question. How Katniss' life changed due to her father's death. I need to write a paragraph assignment on how Katniss' life changed after the death of her father. Good luck with this poor grammar. Discussing three significant consequences. Also, I need to do another. How Katniss's feelings evolve over the course of the book, blah, 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 blah. So, I don't want to, like, give, like, the three consequences, but what do you think of the fact that they didn't show Katniss's father ever throughout the trilogy or even discuss him, really?
I mean, it's one of the things where there had to be a compelling plot reason why Katniss was the one who was providing and knew how to hunt and take care of the family, and thus it was a significant burden for her to be taken by the state, Pan Am, when she went. And it was a compelling reason for her as well to absolutely need to get out. Not just a matter of wanting to save her life, but thinking that her entire family's fate basically rests on her surviving. So I don't necessarily think they needed to show anything other than the fact that he was gone and it was someone she cared about, and that's it.
I agree, but what I think really stands out here is they killed off the father. And it was a completely, she didn't have any brothers either. So, I mean, again, talking about strong female hero that Katniss is, and she's such a strong female hero, doesn't this add to the fact that she's a strong female hero, that there was no man in the house?
I think so. I mean, I think she then takes on a non-traditional feminist role, which should make her a hero, a feminist hero in that regard, but probably just makes her, more oppressive than other women because she's too masculine.
Really?
I don't know. I'm trying to think about someone who's mentally deficient, i.e. a feminist.
I mean, she's stronger than PETA, right? And in some ways, she's stronger than Gale, too. So.
Yeah. But she's stronger while maintaining a feminism about her.
Femininity.
Yes. Absolutely. I don't know. I don't have any thoughts about the father. I don't look at these things as, I mean, I understand them from a plot point, but it's a given to me. It's not something where I go, oh, well, what are the psychological consequences? What kind of teacher assigns this kind of essay? This is some of the most non-essential stuff I've ever heard in writing about this book.
Well, they're teaching naturalism because they don't understand how to analyze from theme point of view. I mean, to go into a little bit of what I do when I tutor, I have to teach this basic thing. I have to teach, what's the backbone of a story? It's the theme. Here are the things a writer does to show you how to figure out the theme. Once you figure out the theme, everything is connected to it, and then you can understand what everything means. And they don't know that. That's like a difficult process to do. I'm like teaching them a foreign language.
Yeah. Alas, non-essential terribleness.
All right, well, another thing in Mockingjay was all about using Katniss as propaganda against the Pan Am, right, against the Capitol. So here, let's go to our next question. How much of what I'm watching on TV is really propaganda? Here's the description. I'm all too aware most of the news reports, etc. I get are propaganda designed to manipulate my thoughts, perceptions, opinions, and ultimately my reality and the world around me. Wow, you can use propaganda to manipulate reality? But how much of what I'm watching is really propaganda? I mean, it doesn't take a brain surgeon to discover the CIA is American state-sponsored terrorism.
Jeez.
But the other day I was watching a documentary on Discovery, can't remember it, but in general it just portrayed the CIA as heroes on a mission from God, great men with morals and honor. Yeah, right. Sometimes I wonder if it's better to get rid of TV completely.
You know this dude is living in a bus, like a broken down hippie bus out in like the woods in Oregon, you know, Oregon with like a bunker underneath, you know, that you access with a ladder. Like you just know that that's what this guy is.
I tend to think it's a high school kid who's been brainwashed to believe all this stuff.
No way. I think he's like a John Malkovich in Red. Like that's what he is.
Well, we're making old people movie references today. Grey Gardens, Red.
Red's a good movie. It's recent.
It is a good movie, but it's all old people.
It is all old people. My grandfather loved it. How much is propaganda? Well, from his perspective, it sounds like where the CIA is state-sponsored terrorism, then I'm assuming a lot of what he's going to watch on TV to him is propaganda. But what is genuinely propaganda? Again, propaganda has a meaning and is a form of persuasion that's usually used by governments to increase nationalism and, you know, create scare tactics around a given topic, especially in a time of war. So very little of what we watch on TV is propaganda. It may be marketing that you disagree with. It may be
terrible journalism that you disagree with. It may be art that you disagree with. That doesn't mean it's propaganda. Don't call everything propaganda.
Yeah, we talked about this the other day where we said that they thought, the people who hold this perspective, thought anyone who argued against you and didn't believe what you did, that was force. Anyone who tried to convince you of anything, they consider that force.
Mm-hmm. And you can see this in exactly what you pointed out, which is designed to manipulate ultimately my reality. That's what they believe that persuasion that they disagree with is. Force manipulating their reality. It's a very twisted view on force versus persuasion.
But it's just interesting, like what he's already conceded. Oh, it doesn't take a brain surgeon to find out that the CIA is state-sponsored terrorism. Like, well, wait a minute. What do you mean? How did you come to that? I mean, this is a kid who really needs to check his premises. I mean, really he does, because he's conceded things for which he has no evidence and no reason to concede them.
All right, next question. And I'm going to fold the last two questions together. So it's actually going to be like three questions in one, but you'll see how they all go together very easily. So, top 10 best female action heroes of all time. Who is the best female action hero? And female action heroines? So I'll read some of these, just some of the description. So they have a list here of the top 10. They have Angelina Jolie, Sigourney Weaver, Mila Jovovich, which Lulu Dallas multipass, Uma Thurman, Pamela Greer, Carrie Moss, Zoe Bell, Rona Mitra, Michelle Yeoh, Kate Beckinsale. And then the other question has some TV. Xena, Sydney Bristow from Alias, Wonder Woman, Jamie Summers, Sarah Corvin, the Bionic Woman, Max Guevara, which was Dark Angel. And then for female action heroes, they're asking more of a theoretical approach. The stereotype of pulp romance novels is that you have a gruff, physically imposing warrior-type male and a submissive, sassy, but headstrong female. The man physically dominates her, but she conquers him mentally and emotionally. Now, toss that stereotype aside. My question has to do with female leads, particularly in action roles. What defines a great female heroine? What makes a great one different than a poor one? Has women's lib had any influence on a woman in such roles? How does a man define a great female heroine? How does a woman define one?
Okay.
How does the above-mentioned stereotypes factor into this? Thanks. Now, I want to do this in reverse order. Let's define a hero and then say who our favorite female ones are.
Jesus, this is a dissertation, by the way. This isn't like a toss-off Yahoo Answers question. So, hero in the context of art, right?
Mm-hmm. Right. We're not talking about hero in reality. We're talking about in the context of art, in romantic art.
Well, yeah. Okay. Go ahead, Elliot. I dominate these things. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I think hero in the context of art, at least in romantic art, is a volitional character who uses his free will, his volition, to pursue values, and does so by, I would say, according to a code of values or a code of ethics that he uses as principles in order to achieve whatever goal he or she has set out to do.
I was going to say it's a submarine sandwich.
Really?
I'll take issue with you, Elliot, a little bit, and you and I don't usually disagree on this show, so this will be a good treat for our audience. I'll take issue only with, I think you might have rolled in, like, what is a good hero or what is a romantic hero into that. I don't think hero necessarily requires some of the things you put in there. So to me, a hero a little more broadly is basically just the main character or central character in the art who the audience is supposed to identify as having virtue of some sort and with whom they're supposed to, sympathize or feel for in some way.
I don't know, because, I mean, you could sympathize with Walter White, but I don't know that you would classify him a hero.
You cannot sympathize with Walter White if you're not fucking retarded.
Oh, wow.
The second he starts,
that's a claim.
The second he starts killing people to make meth, you gotta say, okay, dude, you've gone over the line. I get it. You got cancer. Your wife's acting like a bitch. You can't pay your bills. I get it. But you're killing people to make meth. You crossed the line. okay? I understand season one. I get people in season one who can think Walter White is a hero. But if you think Walter White's a hero beyond season one, you got problems. Look at yourself in the mirror.
And a bitch ain't one.
Yeah. Well, no, it is if you get your word in season one.
If you are Walter White, then yes.
I'm gonna balance the two things you guys are saying, because I think what you're saying is congruent with each other. But I think, as you're right, Daniel, I think Elliot described the ideal hero. So ideally, in a romantic story, that is the type of hero we would want. But what you're pointing out is, the hero of a story is not only the protagonist, but it's when the protagonist is shown as the most virtuous in the internal morality established by the story.
Yeah. Agreed.
So yours is necessary for Elliot's, but not sufficient for Elliot's. Does that make sense?
Yes. Yes. Absolutely.
Okay, so we're in agreement there, and I would think we're also in agreement that, at least I am, that my ideal heroes would be like Elliot's heroes.
No, I agree with that entirely.
Okay, so then...
In a perfect world, we'd have more of Elliot's heroes and fewer Walter White first season, even.
Right. No, I don't. I mean, I can understand. I can sympathize. I can feel sympathy for Walter White in season one, but even then, I think he's a whiny bitch. But anyway, Walter White season one is very naturalistic, and the show becomes romantic because of the basic premise of it. It had to become romantic because it was dealing with an abstraction of what evil is. Whereas the first show was naturalistically showing that kind of life.
Yeah. Okay.
Anyway, this isn't a Breaking Bad question. So. Who are your guys' favorite female action heroes?
So I think one of them was named on the list that you named, which is Mila Jovovich. I thought, and still think, her portrayal in The Fifth Element is tremendous. Because it's a mixture, I think, of what that person put out there as the sassy, headstrong female, but she's also the physically imposing warrior.
Right, and she carries that over into Resident Evil as well, the physically imposing female.
Yes. I haven't really seen those, but my girlfriend adores them because of her character, not particularly because of anything else. But so she's definitely one. One that's not on this list that I definitely think should be, and I hope I have all of your support for this as well, is Summer Glau.
Yes. Very good. Very good.
From Serenity.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Agreed.
That's true. Buffy's not on here. Sarah Michelle Gellar's not on here.
Yep, they didn't put Buffy on at all. They didn't put any Joss Whedon characters. How do you do that? How can you talk about female empowerment and action heroes and not put any Joss Whedon characters on there?
Nobody
Buffy,
from
Faith.
But yeah, none of them are there.
I mean, even Cordelia and Angel, Fred and Angel, all of the women in Firefly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Very much so. Definitely not an extensive list this person gave.
I mean, I agree with Uma Thurman and Kill Bill, one of my favorite like movies. I think it's so much fun. But I really am pleasantly surprised that she included Zoe, or he included Zoe Bell. I adore Zoe Bell. Because I loved her when I saw her in Death Proof, because she's a stunt performer who also, in that movie, she was playing herself. And in the big car chase at the end, she's actually on the hood of the car. And it shows because he's filming her as the car is moving and she's on the hood. And it's just, I mean, she's badass all the way. I loved her. And then I do think that they should have included, again, another Whedon character that didn't include, Melinda May. Ming-Na Wen, she's not on the
list. Yeah, how can you not include her? I mean, if you're gonna talk about Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. and how awesome it is, she is the best part of that show.
Oh, yeah. She's probably the most consistent character, I think, in that show, too.
And if you look at the history of who she's played Mulan, played Chun-Li. Female action star, she needs to have a bigger career than she has. She is tremendous on Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
Yeah. I'm amazed that she's not on the list. She should be. But she's a Whedon character. I guess maybe this person just has it in for Whedon.
Yeah, or they're not aware of Whedon.
That's true.
Would we put Black Widow on this list?
Oh, no, she's not on here either.
I wouldn't. Whatever. Not my favorite character.
But... Black Widow?
Yeah.
You don't like Widow?
Not interested. Nope.
She can't not interested.
She's well, too talky.
We'll add Gal Gadot on this soon.
Yes.
I want to also add another controversial one, which would be Zoe Saldana, who I think does a tremendous job in action movies, including the much unseen movie Colombiana, which I thought she just totally kicked ass in that movie. Oh, what's her name? From, help me, Justin, from Lost.
Kate?
No, absolutely not.
Which
no,
one?
Hispanic.
Yeah, I was gonna.
Michelle Rodriguez.
Yeah, if you look at her, you look at her in Resident Evil. You look at her in Fast and the Furious, and then you even look at her. You know where she's really badass? If you want to see some badass women, watch Machete and Machete Kills.
Oh yeah, I forgot about Machete. I love Machete.
The women in Machete and Machete Kills are so fucking badass. It's awesome.
I love.
I'd add Vanessa Ferlito to this list too. I like Vanessa. She's awesome. She was great in Death Proof, but I really love her. She's on the show Graceland, and she's just awesome.
Excellent. Very good list, gentlemen. Very
and,
proud of us.
You know, The Walking Dead, the women in that. I mean, Michonne's pretty badass. Maggie's become pretty badass. So, and they're making Sasha pretty badass.
Carol.
Carol, yeah. How can you not mention Carol, right? She fucking blew up Terminus.
Right.
And then I am going to add the controversial pick. I'm just going to say Sucker Punch.
All of Sucker Punch?
All of Sucker Punch.
That is pretty controversial, but I tend to agree with you. Yeah.
When I see it, I'm sure I'll agree.
Speaking of stereotypes, Daniel did not have to deal with a watermelon smashing comedian. It's a case of double identity confusion in Not That,
when
D. Richards.
When comes to town, you know it's like a rainstorm. In your browser.
So I'm lucky enough to have a tremendous email address. It's drichards@gmail.com. I'll tell you that because, frankly, I don't care how many other emails I get. I get hundreds of emails every week for Dennis Richards, Dave Richards, Dwayne Richards, Denise Richards many times, her fan club. And I tend to respond to every single one of them telling them I'm not that D. Richards. So short one this week, but one that I couldn't pass up because it's amusing, if even for one line. But I get an email that's addressed to Gallagher Services, which I believe is what Justin was referring to, and I said I didn't have to deal with watermelon smashing comedians.
Yeah, when I saw that, I was like, what do they do? They show up and like they go to like a farmer's market and like smash all the watermelons and run away? Like, what are their services?
No, they're the company that specifically services Gallagher. So they provide ponchos, large wooden mallets, lifetime supply of watermelons.
Bring me a watermelon! Why? I want to smash it!
Berets, mustache cream, all that kind of stuff. So it says, Dear Gallagher Services, effective 21 June 2014, I, Carnell, will be terminated. By the way, Carnell was in parentheses. So not I, comma, Carnell, comma, I, parentheses, Carnell, end parentheses, will be terminating my employment. It has been a great experience working in a field, comma, I thought never could or would.
See, they're growing
watermelons.
So he's putting
his scarecrow.
In the field, they're growing watermelons.
This is becoming racist, by the way.
Wow. I didn't mean that. Times... Disclaimer.
His name is Carnell. The time spent with the individuals has been an invaluable life lesson. The time spent with the individuals. But, comma, another opportunity has come along that will allow me more independence. The Emancipation Proclamation, namely.
Yeah, you turned this into some weird slavery thing.
You with the watermelons in the field. I said he was a scarecrow. Yours truly, Carnell, copy Carol. That's it. This is the kind of thing I get at my email address. And I'm like, what do I do with this?
What
and it's in a PDF.
What do you do when you can't even quit your job properly?
You're incompetent to quit your job. No, I honestly think in this case, he was probably trying to copy himself And maybe he has C. Richards. Maybe he's that lucky fella. And he mistyped it because it is one letter away on the keyboard. But this is the kind of shit I get dozens of every single day. Scarecrows. Scarecrows, Justin. Scarecrows, Elliot. That's who I get.
One of these days you will smarten up and get another email. But it's such
a convenient email address.
Apparently not.
You gotta take the negative with the positive.
In the meantime, I'm D. Richards, just not that D. Richards.
All right, gentlemen. What did we learn this week? Daniel?
I learned that Barry One is not a rapist and is also not Obama.
That was mine!
Really?
Yes!
I also learned that the Revolution is a soccer team.
A very, very depressing soccer team.
Yes. Elliot? And the librarians are cool again.
I learned that men are going away from women, but that does not mean that they are going towards men. So the ranks of the homosexuals are not increasing. They are not swelling.
Dude, just move to West Hollywood already. Seriously.
You couldn't pay me to live in California right now, dude.
Doesn't mean they're not swelling there, Elliot. They're swelling.
I'm sure they're swelling. They're just the ranks are not swelling.
Yeah.
And I learned that if I ever want to insult someone, I can just call them a goofball and they won't realize that I'm insulting them.
It's true. They'll think it's some cheerful, lovely, playful name. And when in fact, their ideology is such that they want to destroy your entire being.
Right. And if you want to call us a goofball, you should do it on iTunes with a 5-star rating.
Goofballs! 5-star rating. Love it. That's a good idea.
Yeah,
I think we should take. We should make goofballs. Yeah, we should make goofball happen. I want to take this word back.
Reclaim goofball.
Reclaim goofball.
I'm not even kidding. I think we should just instead of calling people assholes from now on, you're just a goofball.
Oh, you goofball! I think it's mildly racist. I mean, to the great goof troop of
Goof Troop.
So yeah, definitely reach out to us on iTunes, 5-star review. Also tweet at us at the Midside. Tell us what you thought of the show. And more importantly, tell a friend what you thought of the show. Our audiences are growing by tens every month because of your word of mouth. And we couldn't thank you more for it. We get lovely messages every day saying that they heard about our show from you.
I'm Justin M. Wisniewski, and I hope you learned something this week. This concludes your journey into the Midside. Good luck out there, and remember, if things get tough, take a step back and witness the farce.
Have a day!
It's one thing to be criticized, but it's another thing to be criticized by people who have no idea what they're talking about. End of subject.